Right now, I'm joined on the phone by Robert Bryan. He is former chair of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, which is in Washington, D.C. He is now on the steering committee of the World Coalition Against the Death Penalty, which is in Paris. He has tried over 100 murder cases. He specializes in death penalty work. He's active in the National Lawyers Guild, and he is Mumia Abu-Jamal's lead attorney. He's joining me today to give us a legal update on Mumia's case. Hello, Robert.
Hi, George. It's great to be talking with you. And I was just thinking, you're talking about this incredible program that the Mobilization to Free Mumia is putting together for September 17 here in San Francisco at the Great American Music Hall. I hate to say it, I can't go. I'm going to be actually speaking in Paris that afternoon at the Fête des Humanités, which is an annual event that draws over a million over the weekend. It's been going on for decades, just north of Paris, and they put together a program in which I'm speaking on behalf of Mumia, a member of the Communist Party who's in the French Senate. We'll also be speaking. So Mumia is being will be well represented on September 17, really around the globe.
Before we get into talking about the current legal situation and having an update on that, can you tell us how you came to represent Mumia?
Well, it's Mumia and I sometimes joke that maybe we hope we're both like good wine, that we age well, we're getting better with age. He actually wrote me, George, in 1986, believe it or not, that's a long time ago. Two decades, he wrote me, and then we periodically corresponded. Finally, I met with him in 1991, he asked me to represent him. I got back to San Francisco from Pennsylvania, thought about it, and I just said, "Look, Robert, I'm just too busy, you know, to take on another death penalty case. My plate was really full, so I had to decline, and it was with great reluctance that I did." He came back to me, George, and through the years after that, even though I did not represent him, I would speak at various rallies on behalf of Mumia. Finally, about 4 years ago, he came back to me and asked me would I reconsider, because he was really getting in the home stretch with his case, and this time around, I could not say no, and I like to be able to sleep well at night, and it's just so important. He is, and what he is doing represents in a representative capacity to, you know, people everywhere who are falsely imprisoned on death row, both here and in other countries. I had to take it this time around, and it's a lot of work, but it's a great cause we're involved in. It really is.
And when you say that, can you explain what you mean it's a great cause that you're involved in?
Well, Mumia has become, and I'm sure you're very much aware of this, has become recognized really around the world as a symbol of the fight against the death penalty in many countries. He has also become a international symbol against the imprisoned, the disenfranchised of the globe. He's African American. He's a journalist, and part of the reason, what this case really is about is the government, the authorities trying to shut him up, shut him down. They want him to be quiet. And it's interesting that when Mumia was arrested in 1981, December of 1981, he was already known as an incredibly top-flight radio journalist, and he was referred to as the voice of the voiceless. The authorities thought by putting him on death row that they would silence the voice of the voiceless. Interestingly, particularly through the good work of Noel at prison radio, his dispatches weekly, his commentaries from death row are now heard around the world by radio stations, not only here in this country, but in many other countries. And you know, I'm sure you're very familiar with, he talks about everything from the rights of women to against capital punishment, against the many illegal acts by the Bush administration, et cetera, et cetera. But he always writes about and talks about things other than himself, that just seems to give more importance to what he's about, because he's so much of a representative of people everywhere who are in places they should not be, like on death row.
So what is the current situation? Where are you at with this case at the moment?
Well, we're in the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which sits in Philadelphia. It's just below the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court last December, the court will only hear issues that have been certified, so they do not have to take everything. Even though we've got a smorgasbord of fraud and unfairness in this case, what the court did is it's hearing four issues. But on December 6th, the court certified some issues that we were pleasantly surprised that the court wanted to hear. One of them involves the unfairness, the bias of the trial judge, Albert Szabo. And I was really surprised, just because you don't expect courts to be fair and to take on sometimes the most difficult questions, but they did take this issue. And this issue involves not just the bias of the judge, but let's call it what it is racism. And, you know, evidence was uncovered a few years ago. And I'm going to use an expression that the judge used. It's not mine. It's, I think, the worst word in the English language, so I guess it's okay on radio, the N-word. But what the judge said during the trial, he was overheard by a stenographer. He said, in reference to Mumia, he said, "I'm going to help him fry the nigger." I've been before some racist judges, particularly in the South. Even once spent 3 days in jail on a case, murder case I won. My client was acquitted, and I went to jail fighting a racist judge. But I've never seen a judge, known of a judge, who was so arrogant as to admit his or her bias, racism, but this judge did. We've got another issue of racism and jury selection. It's called the Batson issue because it's named after a very well-known case, Supreme Court case, the Batson case, in which the prosecution in this case systematically removed African-Americans, people of color, from sitting on the jury. This is really... I think both this and the judge issue are of incredible importance, because a thread that ran through this case from the beginning in December of 1981 through today is racism. And that a federal court has said that it wants to hear two issues that involve this very thread, this issue of racism, is very encouraging to me. We also have another issue involving a prosecutor telling the jury that if they err, in effect, what he said was, if they err, they should err on the side of conviction. In other words, what the prosecution did is turn reasonable doubt on its head, inside out, presumption of innocence. He said there would be appeal after appeal. So, and then, of course, the fourth issue is the one involving the death penalty. So, That's where we are. We're doing a lot of briefing. My opening brief was filed over the summer, our opening brief, which is quite big and supported by extensive exhibits. The prosecution filed a brief before that. We've got cross appeals in this case, incidentally. I filed a response. There are some other briefs that have been filed that I don't know if you want to hear about, by two national organizations of great importance. So the case is moving very rapidly, and we're pursuing relief very aggressively.
So once the briefing phase is complete, you're going to present an oral argument before a three-judge panel in the U.S. Court of Appeals. Right.
Exactly. That's correct.
So what do you, What is the practical, I guess, a more something for somebody who doesn't really understand all of the legal
Well, you know, I mean,
aspects?
if, to put it in a nutshell, we're in the process of extensive briefing in a very complicated, complex case. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give it a 10. Once all that's completed, the court will set a date, which is presently unknown, for oral argument before, as you mentioned, a three-judge panel. It's like, you know, going before God. You know, they're sitting up there above you. Then sometime after that, the court will render a decision. And also joining us in this cause, this great cause, is the National Lawyers Guild. Sophia Elijah from Harvard Law School has, along with some other people from the National Lawyers Guild, have written a very good brief in support of three of the issues. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund has, and this is a what we call an amicus brief, amicus curiae, friend of the court brief, filed by the National Lawyers Guild. Also, a second amicus brief, friend of the court brief, has been submitted by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York. And the issue they have tackled, taken on, is the jury selection issue, the racism and jury selection. So I mean, this has really been a boost for us as far as trying to establish for this court the unfairness of the trial. But what our goal is, I mean, oral argument, what we want is the Court of Appeals to order a new trial. First trial was a total fraud, a sham, and filled with half-truths at best, a lot of lies, and that's not going to happen again.
And what do you think the likelihood of achieving this is?
Well, George, I feel it's very high. I am just I think we're getting a lot of support in the legal community. The people working with me are superb. Professor Judith Ritter, who teaches in Delaware at the law school there, is my associate counsel. I think comparing this to the many other death penalty cases I've handled, it's going along quite good. We have another brief due on, I believe it's October 4, a reply brief. I mean, briefs are going back and forth by both sides, but I feel like I'm very encouraged. But however, I'm going to throw a little water on that, a word of caution. This case is on the fast track, and I may, if you'd like, maybe I could give a couple of scenarios of what might happen.
Please.
One scenario would be, of course, we get a new trial. And then we go back to the very beginning, and it would be quite different from the first trial. And of course, my objective in all of this, our objective, is to win a new trial, and at the end of that trial, that Mamiya will be acquitted and can go home to his family. I mean, the ultimate objective is his freedom. So we're talking about a new trial, but it's for his freedom. Another scenario, the court could deny what we're arguing, grant what the prosecution's arguing, and uphold the death penalty. And this is the other end of the spectrum. If that happens, and this is reality, this could happen. I hope it will not, but Mamiya would die in the death chamber. So I mean, people need to understand that Mamiya remains in great jeopardy. He's been sitting on death row nearly a quarter of a century. And of all the cases I've handled, the other side, the prosecution, the government's always very diligent in trying to kill the client, our clients. But I've never seen a case in which they so aggressively want to see a client dead as in Mamiya's case. I mean, they saw that they could not silence him, his journalism, by putting him on death row, and so they're trying to kill him. I mean, that's the bottom line. That's what all this is about, is that the government's trying to murder him.
It may not
in the name of the law.
Just be the political reasons, which certainly are pretty present there, but also covering their own tracks too.
I mean, there was
a lot of things done in the quote-unquote investigation of the killing of Officer Daniel Faulkner that was ultimately pinned on Mumia that were extremely questionable, to say the least.
Well, the prosecution, I mean, this is not just a case where a mistaken identity, that type of thing, which we've seen, you know, it's not that uncommon to see that, where somebody will identify somebody else or may make a mistake. In this case, we have evidence that the prosecution deliberately got people to lie. For example, there's one witness, Cynthia White, who claimed that she saw Mumia shoot Faulkner. She wasn't even present at the time the shooting occurred. She came along afterwards, but the police put a lot of pressure on her and said, "Look, you help us, we'll help you." And she admitted that. She's admitted that to other people, that they got her to lie. Another witness, who was a security guard, a wannabe cop at the hospital where Mumia was brought, you know, he had been shot in the chest. You know, she has admitted to some people that the police said, "Well, look, we're all the boys in blue, and we've got to stick together. And we all know this terrible guy did this terrible thing to Faulkner, one of our own, and we need you to, you know, say that he said he did it, which he did not." And there's a lot like that occurred in this case. And you know, if I've ever seen a case, and I've seen a lot of fraud, but this was really trial by fraud. Not only unfairness, and it reeked of racism and bias, but and it was a very hostile atmosphere. But it was in lack of a defense. There was basically no defense investigation, and the defense attorney even asked the judge to relieve him of his appointment. He said, "Judge, I do not want to even be here. You know, let me out of the case." So it seems this is a case in which, if anything could go wrong, it did go wrong. And it's like this case is I used the word smorgasbord in another context earlier. This case is a smorgasbord of what can go wrong. In any case, it all happened here. The racism, the fraud, the lying, a person who could not afford experts and investigation because he did not have the money. He was had incompetent representation. You know, so forth and so on. It was all in this case, and this case, Mumia's case. He hopes. He always reminds me when I speak on his behalf to remind people, the audience, that this case is not about him. He says, "Robert, it's not about me. It's about all people situated as I am, and all political prisoners, and all people." Mm-hmm. Death row, and all people who are in prisons who shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. He said, "It's me as a symbol." But I find it remarkable that he, through all of this, has maintained such a positive attitude, moral courage, that he continues to worry about other people rather than himself. I mean, as you know, my practice is confined strictly to representing people facing the death penalty, and naturally, most of them are worried about themselves. And of course, he wants to go home to his family, but he's always talking about other people, not himself.
Robert, we only have a couple of minutes left. I have to get through my last couple of questions quickly, if possible. Somebody emailed a question saying, first of all, they quoted Rachel Wolff. Wolkenstein's affidavits, which from the point number 30, which this is a quote from. "Moreover, the police ballistics report states that the bullet taken from Faulkner's head wound is extremely mutilated and distorted, destroying the major portion of the rifling markings such that even its general characteristics are indeterminable. The ballistics report, which was unsigned, concluded that a comparative examination of the evidence bullet against test-fired bullets has shown insufficient characteristic markings to permit a positive comparison. However, a photograph taken of this bullet discloses a largely intact lead bullet with pronounced filing impressions, indicating that a comparative analysis with original exemplar bullets fired from it could have resulted in a determination as to whether the bullet was fired from Jamal's Chapter Arms revolver. Additionally, the relative width of the lands to the grooves on the bullet reportedly taken from Faulkner's head wound is the opposite of all but a few percent of the Chapter Arms revolvers produced. Thus, the prosecution's ballistics evidence, or lack thereof, itself raises a strong likelihood that the bullet and evidence from Faulkner's head wound was not fired from Jamal's Chapter Arms revolver, and that police ballistics tests were, quote, inconclusive because properly and competently performed ballistics would exclude Jamal's gun as the murder weapon. The question is, considering that Judge Szabo's bias during the 1995-97 PCRA hearings may have resulted in the improper exclusion of this evidence from consideration and proper re-examination, that's the ballistics evidence, is it possible to argue that the ballistics should be re-examined under the part of the appeal that deals with Szabo's bias? In particular, Judge Szabo allowed the prosecution to get their hands on the physical evidence for 24 hours unsupervised. This is a serious breach that should not go unchallenged.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, what Rachel, I've known Rachel for, I guess we've known each other over 15 years, and, you know, I have very fond feelings about her, and what she wrote, I could not say it better. I mean, that's what's quoted, you just quoted, is exactly on point. That's true, and I support it 100%. The problem I'm stuck with at this point in the appeal is I'm stuck with evidence that's been previously presented on this specific issue, and we are raising everything we can on this issue, and this is, you know, basically part and parcel of it as we can try to weave it in. So I think this is a very good point raised.
So do you think you're saying it might be possible to
I'm not sure. I'd have to look. You know, we've got a whole team of people, and believe me, everything that could be possibly covered in this issue, you know, is being raised. One of the problems we've got with this issue about Szabo is that I'm kind of stuck with what my predecessors did, and you can't reinvent things when you're on appeal, and one of the problems is the attorneys previously in the case did not, what they did is raised his bias at the evidentiary hearing, what they call Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing, PCRA hearing in 1995, but they did not include in that his bias and unfairness at the trial, which is, so it's, but we're making the best of that, even though that oversight, there's that oversight I'm kind of stuck with. If we can win on this issue, it pulls out from it destroys the foundation of the federal court decision denying relief, because the federal judge Yon based his decision on what Szabo what was decided in the state court, the court of common pleas, the trial court, and if in fact those decisions that came out of that 95 et cetera hearing were made by a biased judge and therefore not reliable, therefore thus the whole underpinnings of the federal decision denying relief have been wiped out. So it's still we've turned lemons into lemonade as far as this issue. So
right.
But I can assure you no stone's being unturned not overturned. I can assure you of that.
So Robert, can you give us in 2 minutes or so the overview, really quick, again, of the current situation with Mumia, and then finally, what people can do to support getting justice.
The case, as we've talked about, but in some detail, and I'll just hit the peaks instead of the going into the valleys. We're before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia. We're in aggressive briefing and cross briefing, and it's. Very complicated, as complicated as I've ever seen, if not more so. There will eventually be oral argument before a three-judge panel sometime after that, and only God and the court know when. There will be a decision. Whoever loses is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. That much I can be assured. People can be assured. Our goal is a new trial, and that Mamiya be acquitted. And I might mention, I know you're short on time, but I've recently discovered, we recently uncovered a series of 26 photographs that were previously unknown of the homicide scene. And they totally, George, established that the prosecution manipulated evidence, moved things around. We're holding both Faulkner's pistol and the one that Mamiya had with a license for. They were just walking around, accomplices. You can see in the pictures holding these pistols. I mean, it was not only manipulating evidence, but things that in somebody in Yazoo, Mississippi, or some Hicksville, USA, would not do at the crime scene. I mean, it was incredible. Anyway, the goal is to win and get Mamiya Abdul-Jamal out of prison and him home to his family and to the public. And but people need to bear in mind that the case could go the other way, that he is in great jeopardy, and we need to be very vigilant. What we need is public support. We need people making noise about this case, whether it be demonstrating, writing letters to the editor, doing petitions, whatever a person feels comfortable doing, he or she need to do. I mean, public support, public attention to this case, I feel is crucial. This is a political case. This man would not be in prison. He would not be on death row if he were not African American, if he were not a prominent journalist. And we just need people to help. And you mentioned the mobilization to free Mamiya. I believe you gave the website.
FreeMamiya.org.
Yeah, FreeMamiya.org. That's a great place to go if people want to help. There are a number of other organizations that have websites, and I just ask people to get involved, do what they can. It's really, really important. You know, I go to France. I just came back from some meetings there and in England on the case, and I'm going back on Friday to speak on Sunday at the Fête de l'Humanité, and it's just, you know, you see this outpouring of thousands of people who really care, their support there, and you see it here, and we just need more of it. People just need to make noise. I mean, it's intolerable that what's happened to this man, and I not only me, but I speak for thousands of other people. We're not going to rest until he's free.
Yeah, what is happening to him right now as we speak? He sits on death row in Pennsylvania. So thank you.
And may I say one other thing? What you are doing, what you did this afternoon in talking about this case with me for the past 30 minutes, it is, you know, it is so important. And what you're doing is exactly what I'm talking about. And I want to thank you for your concern for Mamiya. I'll be talking to him on Wednesday. I can tell you in advance what he'll say. He's always very humble, which is very interesting. But he'll say, would you please tell George and our audience that I just said thank you for caring. Thank you for being there for all of us.
Thank you, Robert, for being here with me today.
Thank you, George.
And you have a good night now.
You too.
Bye-bye. That was Robert Bryan, lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. I want to let you know again that you can learn more by going to the website freemumia.org. That's for the mobilization to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. You can learn about their upcoming event that's happening on Sunday, September 17th at the Great American Music Hall. It's a night of music and poetry for Mumia, with Boots Riley of The Coup, Jack Hirschman, Devorah Major, Jonathan Richman, Andre the Wonder Woman, Nehru, Matt Gonzalez, Upsurge, Omo Shango, Agneta Falk, Merle Wu, Nellie Wong, and Jeff Mackler, a night of music and poetry for Mumia Abu-Jamal. The proceeds from that going to benefit the mobilization to free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, their website, freemumia.org. You can go there to learn more about this event.